Hey, Tom here from the Run Testers, and welcome back for another Points of Shoe podcast. In this episode, myself and Nick are going to be talking about various things that you have asked us, including how do we retain our non-biased views when we're reviewing shoes? Do you really need to buy super shoes when you're running a marathon? And do we ever review a shoe and find out later that we've changed our mind about it? Right, let's dive in and see what answers we've given. All right, Nick, how's it going?
Good, good. More to the point, how are you? Just back from the big... Has Boston got a nickname?
I don't think so.
Okay, the big Boston.
I'm back from the big Boston, yeah. I've got to put my video up about this. Well, the video will be up by the time this podcast goes up.
Yeah, well, tough day. Humid, it sounded like.
Very unsuccessful day. Yes, it was very hot, very humid. Not my ideal marathon. Probably won't go down as one of my fondest runs, but I did enjoy the actual event and the going to Boston. So
very hard on the tracker, Boston, just because me and Mike are tracking you, and it's... he's gone quick there. And then you have to go to the elevation profile and go, okay, that's a downhill section. And then you go, is he slowing down or is it a hill? You don't really know what's going on until you're running like, 10-minute miles.
It is such a hard, even without the weather, it's so hard to pace that race because you have to stop yourself from running fast on the downhills. And then you've got to work out whether you try and maintain your pace. And it's very hard to work out how long you're actually taking. Because you can't quite plan it out. So it's a really, really difficult race. But with the heat, it was incredibly difficult. And I think I'll just focus on Valencia.
Yeah, Valencia's better. It wasn't meant to be that hot, was it, the forecast? It just came out. No, yeah. Oh, well, you still... I mean, to be honest, it obviously is a bad time for you now, but it's pretty similar to what you used to do when you rocked up and ate McDonald's and just walked out and ran it. So,
well, it's still faster than that. This is probably like my fourth fastest marathon still. Considering I walked for the majority of the last 10K. I went across the halfway line at 1:29 or something. So
yeah, well, it was 5K, it was sub 20, then it was 40-minute 10.
Yeah.
And then when's Heartbreak Hills? 20 miles, is it?
20 miles, yeah.
Is it notably worse than the other hills?
Yeah. But only it depends. I don't think... If I had hit that hill in Berlin, I don't think I would have minded that much, just because I was in such a state by that point anyway. But it's just long. So like all the other hills, there's probably about, they're not massive hills, but you can see them coming up, and they're probably like, most of them are 30 seconds to a minute, whereas this is like a whole four minutes of running uphill, which that point really, really sort of gets you.
It really felt like me and Mike watch again. I think... I'm really worried he's injured and he's going to not accept not finishing because he's spent a lot of money and bought an incredible amount of Boston Marathon gear. And he's like his calf is hanging off his leg, but he will finish it.
I tell you what, there is a thing with Boston. Like a lot of people, I was chatting to a guy on the flight who didn't finish it because he went to hospital at about 18 miles. And he was saying, I really wanted to finish it, and they said you're not allowed to finish it because obviously you're so bad, but you go over and you spend so much money on it, and obviously some people have trained for that and they might never get the opportunity to do it again.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
So you sort of think, well, I've got to do it now because I can't just not finish it. But for me, when I got to about 50K, I was thinking, well, I'd much rather just come to be finished than risk not finishing it and then having to spend all the money again.
That's true. Anyway, we'll cover all this in the proper marathons pod.
Yes.
This is Points of Shoe, Tom.
This is Points of Shoe, yeah. Right. Well, as you're pushing me along, because I'm sure you've got other things to do. You're a busy man. Let's start with the first question then.
Just it.
So this is a really good one, actually. This is from Edward. He says, some of the shoe reviews videos posted online are done by running shoe shops. Other shoe reviewers are often sponsored by particular brands. How do the run testers maintain editorial independence in an industry where shoe companies are keen for good reviews? Very good question, and one that we talk about quite a lot in the current world of shoe reviews.
It's a tricky one, really, and I can see why on the outside looking in, it all looks quite similar and not great. But we're all journalists, so we've always been journalists. We've always done impartial reviews. Journalism has always worked like this, as in things come into the whatever branch of journalism you're in. I know it sounds amazing to get pairs of free shoes, but there are people reviewing laptops are getting free laptops because that's
holidays, all sorts.
I did a bit of travel journalism for a couple of months, and it was loads of holidays. It was great, but the point is that's it's kind of your job, to be impartial. Mm. And actually, I would say when you are in that sphere, the brand expect it's quite actually there's no brand I think that really are that worried about negative reviews to that extent that they're like pushing. I've never been pushed to give a positive review of anything. I'll say that. And brands treat you exactly the same way because that's just how it works. Because we are like we're journalists. Obviously, on YouTube, we're viewed as differently, I guess, but we still view ourselves as journalists just on YouTube. And it's just never something that ever even cropped my mind. Like, we do try and avoid any kind of partnerships that would create conflict of interest. We say no to lots of things that would create any kind of conflict, it's fair to say.
Yeah.
And even if we were confident that we wouldn't have a conflict of interest, we don't want anything to, you know, make it look bad or anything like that. Basically, make it look like it would be a problem. So
yeah,
it is a bit different, I think, the way the brands work with journalists and work with other people in the area, I'd say.
Yeah, when you work for publishing companies, you have to basically sign bribery forms and things. So it's all very, very carefully vetted when you're a journalist working for companies. And I think it really comes down. This sort of question is probably more prescient these days because there's obviously so many non-journalist people reviewing shoes and influencers and things doing it. And for them, it's a very different thing because getting the shoes is the benefit as opposed to for us where we would be getting the shoes and brands don't expect journalists to give a good review. They expect honesty because they know we're not allowed to lie about things. So I think, I suppose there's a couple of ways of looking at it. One is the simple one that is you know, we're journalists and we have sort of rules on how we do stuff. And to be honest, if you watch the channel, it's pretty clear that we're being honest quite a lot of the time because very often we don't like shoes and they're from the same brands from a review that we've said we like the shoes. So, and then the other side of it is as well is that we all have other jobs. This isn't our only job. So it's not
a job really at all. It's very much a free time.
It's very much a free time thing. We're doing this because we have access to these things anyway. It's not, we're not doing the channel to get free things. So yeah, I suppose there's nothing we can say to sort of completely rule out any of these things, but essentially, and I suppose the other part as well is that we actively don't take advertising from any conflicting, which you said earlier. So you will never, you will never seen us reviewing a shoe and it's in partnership with anyone. We don't do that.
Yeah, it is tricky. I always think the biggest thing to do is, you know, you just watch things and you can work out basically. But I will also say that people get a lot of things like, you know, hear people throwing stuff at other people going like, oh, ASICS just really want a positive review. Brands want coverage.
Yes.
They don't actually really care what the view is negative. But I think probably they've done the research and it actually doesn't matter if the thing is positive or negative. As long as the coverage is there, they've done their job and it's in people's minds. So I'll get the same thing. Like, okay, if I put a review up of the shoe, the response will be probably the same if I've given it a 5-star review or we've trashed it because job was to get a journalist to review it impartially. And that, you know, that's what we've done. So I in the end of the day, like you say, people will always have their own thoughts on this, but I always think if you watch the reviews, hopefully we come across as trustworthy and honest because we are and we feel we are. But at the end of the day, you know, there's the only way I guess you could do it is, I don't know. There's no other way to do it, is there really?
Well, I mean, if you look at, if we were taking massive chunks of money from shoe brands, that would probably have an impact on things, but we're not. Yeah. We're getting shoes.
Yeah.
And for us, because we get a lot of shoes because of the jobs we do, that's not really enough to make us biased, is it?
No, I will say that we're all quite very entitled people as well. So getting a pair of shoes doesn't really fight them. But we're all, you know, it's kind of what next?
the other thing as well is that we do work with some brands closely purely from a sort of what shoes are getting released, what sort of technologies are coming out and things. Mm. And a lot of brands we speak to are actually they like the feedback from the shoes. Brands work quite far ahead. They're looking at shoes 3 or 4 years ahead at the moment. And if they watch one of our reviews and we give them a bit of feedback on a shoe now that is useful to them, that's a smart way of using our feedback instead of just going, oh good, they like that shoe, good, that's that job done.
I also think it's a very short-termist idea that brands would pay people to give good reviews because people then would come across bad shoes.
Yes.
And they would stop buying the shoes anyway. It's not like, I think it's quite a different thing to something like, I guess, like fashion where the industry actually sets what is good. Whereas we don't set what is good. We just tell you something we think is good. And if everyone agrees, that shoe becomes very popular.
Yeah.
It's not like if we went, this is the best shoe in the world. And then you tried it and it was terrible. We go, well, Nick said it was good. So I guess it is.
Well, that would be, I mean, we'd really know about it if we said a really bad shoe was great.
Yeah, exactly.
And everybody in the comments started going mad at us because it is an absolutely awful shoe. I mean, sometimes we do get disagreements in the comments, but I think generally people are sort of understanding of what we're saying about things. So,
yeah.
So hopefully that answered the question.
You to answer, but a very good question, important one to keep mentioning and answering as well, because I mean, there is a lot more blurring of lines. When we started journalism, there was nothing like, the industry was very different. It was like we all wrote for print, and the odd website, and the influencers didn't exist, and now it's very different.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Right. Let's jump on to another one. This is another good question as well, actually. This is from Phil, and he says, "Gents, love your work. My question is, how often have you reviewed a shoe, used it further, and then changed your mind about your initial conclusion, for better or for worse?"
So I guess it's from a full review, because from a first run to a full review, we'll change our mind a fair bit.
I think it's thinking more like full review to like 6 months later when you picked up a shoe again.
Not that often, I would say. One big one for me was the Endorphin Pro 3, which obviously Tom still loves and loves forever, but I loved to the point where I was considering using as my main shoe. I gave it glowing reviews and I used it past probably, and after a while, I just went off it slightly. Thought it was an amazing shoe, to be fair. But like, I've never completely changed my mind. I think there have been shoes that I've warmed to. Problem is, I think with running shoes, if you use any shoe a lot, you will warm to it at least a bit more. But there's nothing that's really I've had my head turned too much on.
Yeah, I've got there's two ways of
the ones you've broken, Tom, after reviews, those kind of
I've never picked them up again after I've broken them. So what one way of looking at this is, I think sometimes I think it happens for me depending on the sort of level of training I'm doing throughout the year. So sometimes shoes don't really come into their own until say marathon training, for example. In a given week, normally I run four times a week and I'm not doing a lot of long runs. So, you know, I might be getting up to like 15, 20K. Whereas, I mean, most shoes you can probably gauge from 20K if you're going to find that shoe comfortable for longer. But sometimes that's not true. And there's certain shoes, I think something like the Hoka Mach X, which I don't think is the best shoe in the world, but I really wasn't a fan of it when it came out. And I've used it for a few long runs as part of this marathon training block, and I have warmed to it quite a bit more. I still wouldn't say it's the best one out there, but it's definitely my view has changed based on the volume of training that I'm doing and the types of runs that I'm doing.
Yeah, that's definitely true. There's definitely shoes that will work better at different times of year and will hit you. Sometimes shoe hits you at exactly the right time. Like I just got the Cloud Surfer Trail in, for example, just as the forest turned from a muddy bloodbath into like quite a solid trail.
Well, trail shoes are definitely going to change over time, aren't
they?
Yeah.
But also, it's just arrived at a time where I'm about to do quite a lot of easy running after the marathon. It's like, seems like quite a good dibbly dobbly shoe to knock around the forest, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, if I was trying to do quite a lot of progression runs and stuff like that in the forest, it wouldn't be maybe my favorite. I don't know. It's hard to know. But generally, I don't think it changes that much because you can get quite set in your opinion on a shoe quite quickly, just because the feel. But definitely there is something about what you're doing.
I'm talking small percentages here, so I'd say 95% of the time but then there are occasional ones that crop up. And the other example I would say is that sometimes it depends how long you've not run in the shoe, and this is probably a bit more common recently, where I've really loved a shoe. And I bang on about a shoe being the best shoe in the world. And then a year later, 2 years later, after I've tested 60, 70 other shoes, I'm still banging on about it. And I'll put it on and I'll go, oh, it's not actually as good as I remember, because all the other shoes have overtaken it over the past year and a half. So I do try and pick up some old shoes and just give them another run in. If I'm still talking about them, I'm not going to pick up a Brooks Glycerin 10 and start checking out.
I saw some Brooks Ghost, some like proper original Brooks Ghost the other day. My friend, they're not runner. It was like silvery. They were amazing to see. This is the one time I'd say, and this is something, a red flag to look out for in my reviews, actually, because if I use a shoe when I'm coming back from an injury and I'm just excited to be running again, I tend to like it more than I probably should.
Right.
And then if I use it again a lot later, actually, talk about the Cloud Surfer. The Clouds of a Road shoe I was obsessed with because I used it and I loved it. I know I did some longer runs in it. I didn't like it quite as much. But there's no reviews on the channel or anywhere I've written that I think I don't really stand by to some extent. I probably couch some of them a bit, but pretty happy with all my reviews. I don't think I've
Chamber. Well, I was thinking about the fuel cell TC, a shoe that I wouldn't shut up about for 2 years.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's because, I'm hoping it's because when I picked it up, like a year, 2 years later or whatever, the foam had maybe gone a bit hard or something like that. But I definitely put it on and thought, oh, this isn't as good as I remember.
That was a shoe I used coming back from injury when I first used it. And I was again, yeah, that I thought was amazing. But I used that one for long enough before reviewing that I realized my initial feelings of joy had been.
Well, by the Field Cell TC was one of the first, probably like the first three training super shoes, wasn't it? That came out.
And that was a really good one as well.
Yeah, yeah. But after maybe a year or two after it was released, there were probably another dozen shoes that were doing the similar thing. And then suddenly it wasn't actually that exciting anymore. And when I ran in it, I was thinking, maybe it wasn't that good. But I think, shoes, the progression of shoes just shifts your view on what's good. Okay, let's do another question. Right. Okay. So this is from Ali. And they say, as a novice runner, I recently got the On Cloud Surface 7 and they're amazing. Now, I'm considering adding either the Nike Pegasus 40 or the Hoka Max 6 to my rotation. Which do you think are suitable for beginners like me?
Interesting. Nearly all the buying guides I write, I always say the Pegasus is a good shoe for beginners because it's got a very neutral, normal ride, a high drop, good outsole, usually in a sale. So I do think that's probably more different to the Cloud Surfer than the Hoka is to the Cloud Surfer if you are adding a second shoe, because the Pegasus is just a durable, pretty cushioned shoe. Mm. But then the Hoka's, if you really like the Cloud Surfer, the Hoka's a more rocket shoe. It will probably feel more akin to the Cloud Surfer. I'd say the Pegasus is more of a beginner friendly shoe, but if you like the Cloud Surfer, I would be happy to say the Hoka is the more similar and a nicer shoe than the Pegasus all round. It's just a better shoe than the Pegasus for sure.
It depends what you're talking about when you're saying adding to your rotation, because the Mac 6 would be an addition to the rotation that does a different thing. And the Pegasus 40 is basically just going to be another shoe that you can use.
It's a cushion shoe, yeah. It's probably more cushioned than the Cloud Surfer maybe, but
yeah.
That's quite similar, to be honest.
It's a bit firmer as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Cloud Surfer. But for me, that's not, it's just another shoe. I mean, I think I've not tried the Hoka Max 6, every other Hoka I think would be fine for a beginner. It's just a little bit less cushiony.
Both be okay. If you look at the Pegasus, I'd get the Pegasus 39. It's exactly the same as the 40, a bit lighter, it'd be cheaper.
That's a smart move. Okay, this is a good one. This is from Justin, and he says, cheers from Canada. Do you think the time you expect to race your marathon should be taken into consideration when choosing your race day shoe?
A little bit. I think we talk about this quite a lot lately, haven't we, about certain shoes. I think if you're out there for a very long time, I think issues of stability and comfort become a bigger deal, and some race shoes are very unstable. So that would be something to think about for sure. But it's, there is definitely, that's probably the thing I'd think about the most. Other than that, so if you're out there for a very long time, you don't want to be in a really aggressive shoe, because I think it's just going to be uncomfortable. Tom, you ran a very long marathon recently.
it's a tricky one. I'd probably go the other way, and depending on what's the time you want to do your marathon in, not worry too much about going for the most expensive super shoe, because that's probably it's a difficult one, because people often ask, not just us, it's like a question around the world with so many super shoes. Do I need super shoes for racing, basically?
Yeah.
And I mean, I think they are beneficial for a lot of people. I definitely think my times are faster if I get the right super shoe. But I think there's other things involved as well. It's like, stability and comfort and stuff like that. And if you are, you can go and buy the best super shoe out there. You might be a 5-hour marathon runner, but you want, it's not the main thing you might want from it, shaving off 2% of your five hour marathon time.
And your odds are you'll probably lose that again, because it will be less stable, and you might end up feeling really uncomfortable. People do need different shoes at different times, but I think it's more really down to what your preference is. Like if you are going for a 4-hour marathon and you have put everything into your training, you're in peak condition, this is the peak of the time you can go for, and you really want to get everything out of it, you can look at super shoes for sure. But if you're going in and going, I want a 4.5-hour marathon time, or say you want to go for the exact same thing, a 4-hour marathon time, but it's just roughly the time you're aiming for, you've not necessarily trained loads, you've not done loads of marathons, I would 100% be picking a cushioned, comfortable shoe, because it's it's more about your mindset and what you've put in so far, I think, and what you expect from the race and what you want from the race. But yeah, as it gets longer, I think there definitely will be a benefit to more stability just for time on feet purposes.
Yeah.
And I'd take a plate out if I was going for too long. Because again, plates are stiff. They're not that, they won't be that comfortable if you're on them for too long, I'd say, even with all that soft foam.
Yeah. And thinking about it in terms of marathons as well, I'd definitely say if you're racing a marathon, maybe you put in some other races as well. Try, because I would never want to race a marathon in a super shoe if I hadn't raced a 10K in it or a half marathon. So I knew what it was like.
Or at least on like a hard 20 mile or something. Yeah, basically.
Yeah. So you really got to test them out and see if they work. Because there are some super shoes that I wouldn't want to use for a marathon that just don't work for me. And tricky one. But I mean, super shoes, as long as you've not got any issues that using super shoes, I think they're absolutely fine. You've got to find one that works for you.
Yeah. They're just really expensive as well. So really, I think if you look at the difference between them and like a normal training shoe that might just suit you better isn't going to be as big as the difference that most amateurs, including us, can create in some other way in our life through training or, you know, eating and sleeping. So yeah. I certainly wouldn't go straight into super shoes, no matter what your time is almost.
Okay. I've got another one here, which is also about super shoes. So Thomas says, Tom here from Australia, love the podcast and the YouTube channel, running my second ever marathon in May, aiming for 330 to 340, never owned a super shoe. My first marathon was 358 in the New Balance SC Trainer V2. Should I take one of my current training shoes, the Saucony Dolphin Speed 3, through to race day with over 200 kilometers on them, and how will it hold up over the 42 kilometer distance, or should I invest in a new marathon super shoe? Very similar question to the other one, but a bit more specific.
Well, so this one we can talk about age of shoes maybe.
Yes,
because this is a really hard one for me, because I know a 200 kilometer shoe will be absolutely fine on race day if it's got 200 kilometers, but I would start to panic and think about buying a shoe. And I know that's, I think that's a bad thing, but so I don't know, this is not advice, but you know, once a shoe hits a certain distance for me, I'm thinking, well, if I've really, really got everything into this, I'd probably spend them, like when I bought the Alphafly set of Berlin, I didn't use them, but even the Metaspeed Sky Paris now, you know, I've got 120, 130K on it. That's fine. Yeah. Once I go above 150, I start getting itchy.
Yeah, but Speed 3 is a bit different, isn't it? Because I don't think you lose much from. You wouldn't notice much from the 200 if you get to 200K in it, because it's got that slightly firmer midsole foam.
I think you'd be all right in Speed 3, to be honest. Like, then if you're looking at training, it's a bit different. So my friend literally just asked me about his Tempus for race day, and it's 700 kilometers, and I said if I was at 700 kilometers in any shoe, I probably wouldn't race in it if I was really going for a time. But 200 kilometers in the Speed, I mean, 200 kilometers you'd definitely be fine in like the Alphafly. I've raced a marathon with over 200 kilometers in Alphafly. It felt fine. It wasn't the reason I blew up that day. But yeah, I get a bit itchy myself with super shoes at a certain point.
Yeah, I suppose the other part to this is as well is that he's going down from 358 to 340, which is quite a big drop. And we don't know anything about the training that he's been doing to get there. So definitely, if it was me and I was really like, I mean, it sounds like this guy's really focusing on getting that faster time and that big jump, I would move towards a super shoe at this point, just to give me the best possible, you know, benefits from a shoe.
Second marathon, he says, right?
Yeah.
I wouldn't.
You think, second marathon,
20 minutes I dropped, you know, just on training. I think you should be dropping that on training if you use it. And then the Endorphin Speeds are quicker than the SC Elite V2 as well.
So SC, I suppose the question we'd need to ask him is, have you been training harder?
Your training's been exactly the same. Yeah. The speed will have an edge over the SC Trainer V2 though. So
But
it might well be. It's probably not quite as cushy. But I wouldn't buy a super shoe for that drop, because I think if you're dropping that in your second marathon, I think you've got a bigger gain to come, and that's when I'll probably bring the super shoes in.
Well, I went down from 345 to 330 using the Peg Turbos.
Well, I went from my first marathon in 329 to a 253, and I was using a much heavier Adidas Supernova second one, because I had no idea what I was doing, and I'd done every single run at sub 3 pace. So I was just using the biggest cushion shoe I had, and I spent ages agonizing and picking between that and the Ultra Boost, and they were both exactly the same weight, same foam. I don't know what I was thinking. Looking back, I was a maniac.
Is that the first, what, you used that in the second marathon?
Second marathon, I used the Adidas Supernova,
Blimey.
And then I was just running everything in Adidas pretty much at that point. And then I think it was, where was I getting shoes from? I wasn't reviewing shoes then, so I was just, you know, picking up shoes as and when through general journalism life. You know, sometimes before we were running shoes, people, you just go to an event and they'd be, oh, you can have a set of running shoes. Oh, brilliant. I use these all the time.
Yes. Yeah.
But yeah, that was the first time I really realized what was going on with shoes. And I was standing in Pen 1 at London Marathon in my Adidas Supernova looking around and everyone was wearing flats. And I was going, this is weird. Why are my shoes so much bigger than everyone else? And I've weighed them. They're like 350-gram shoes.
All right, so we've got a chap called Barry. He's saying, hi, team. Thanks for everything you do on the YouTube channel and podcast. You're welcome. Was after your thoughts on a shoe choice for my first 55K Ultra. So it's the first time he's tried this. It's about 50% road hard paths and 50% forest trails in the summer. He's thinking of using the Pegasus Trail, but should I go for a more cushioned option or even a plated shoe like the Endorphin Edge? Well, we should probably... Oh, you have done a forest. You've done a very similar ultra. It wasn't summer and dry, was it?
It was, yeah. It's completely dry. And I would say for this, if I was looking at that race myself and I wanted to go and run it and run well in it, I would be using the Vaporfly, something like that. Yeah. Honestly, not the Vaporfly 3 because we'll get ripped up. But my one was all forest path in the summer with some narrow single trail and lots. It was quite grubby underfoot, but a guy used Vaporflies for it, fine, because there was
I'm going to say here, don't use Vaporflies because we don't know the type of trail that you're running on. If it's got loads of holes and stuff in it, you could
If it's hard packed trail and half road, I would use a road shoe myself. But if it is narrow and twisty and dangerous, then I would use a more stable. I wouldn't necessarily go and get the Edge. I don't think those trail shoes still offer enough over a, unless you're going to go buy the Adidas, new Adidas one, which is brilliant. The Agravic Speed Ultra, which is a very, very good trail super shoe. I used it in that Ultra as well. I think the others don't offer enough over just a cushioned trail shoe.
I think we don't know how fast Barry's planning on running it, but I think it depending on what your focus is. So I've done a 55K Ultra, actually, along the canal paths of Hertfordshire. But I wasn't running, I wasn't going fast. I was just doing it for the distance. And the thing that I can't remember what I wore at the time, I think it was a pair of Adidas. What were those old ones called? The old Terex. Can't remember what they are. The Parley ones.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay.
But it was the really quite heavily cushioned ones. And
really
that was
heavy, yeah.
That was perfect for me because I wasn't trying to go fast. It was pretty hard ground and they were really comfortable. So for me, if I was going for on the terrain that he's talking about, I would go for something like the Fuji Light 3, Asics Fuji Light 3, or the Max Trabuco. Something that's just got a load of cushioning. It almost runs like a road shoe.
You'd be careful on those. If you're actually on proper roads... Because the Endorphin Edge, I would not run on the road for a long period. There's enough lugs there.
No.
So you've got to really make sure your lugs are flat and broad on the shoe.
So I did quite a lot in the Fuji. Did you test the Fuji Light 3? It might be the 2 that I tested.
I didn't test. I haven't tested any Fujis apart from the Fuji Speed.
Fuji Light 3, must have been the 3, I can't remember. But basically, I did a lot of training for an earlier marathon and every run had at least 15K on road. On it, I found it absolutely fine. The lugs are quite small on it, and it was quite a soft midsole. Max Trabuco 3 hasn't got big lugs on it either, and it's quite soft. So something like that I would go for. But if he's going for speed and he's going to be going flat out like he would be running a road marathon, and obviously those are not going to be the best ones for it.
No, Pegasus Trail is a pretty solid option as well, actually, I will say, as long as it's nothing too wet, because it does slip on wet ground.
Right, okay. Doesn't sound like that's a worry for him. He just probably doesn't live in England then.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Okay, right. I think you've got a question, haven't you, that you picked up?
We got a question on the channel. I said I'd answer here because it's not one that we do videos on, is it? What are good prescription glasses for running? So I would say I have tested both very direct prescription glasses for it. So the ones I use at the moment are Rokas that are like tailor-made for running and tailor-made for sports. They've got very grippy iPad and stuff like, the temples. It's all very lightweight and they are brilliant. I've also just used general glasses. And I would say if you go and get a cheap plastic frame pair and basically, the advantage of the Rokas is the fit is amazing with no additions. However, if you get a cheap pair and you buy very cheap silicon grippers and put them on the arms, they will still, and lodge them behind your ears, which is what I did for a long time, they will stay in place just as well as very, very well-made glasses like these. And you'll be able to get, you know, a very cheap pair. Like I say, if you get plastic, you can just wipe them down if you get sweaty, that kind of thing. So I actually think, like, I love these Roka glasses. They are genuinely better and better than the ones I've ever used because they're so light and they're, you know, really well-designed. They stay on the nose well, but I think it's a bit overplayed to really go for a prescription sports glasses. Mm. Like I've had some, and I really like all of them. And I really like the Oakley ones I had as well, which weren't even sports ones. And I used kind of the grippers on the arms just because, you know, they're lighter. And the lenses are obviously very good from those companies as well, which you won't get from just cheap pairs. But you'll probably break them is the other thing. But if you don't break glasses, I know you and Tom and I both are quite good at breaking glasses, I believe. I think you smash sunglasses with alarming regularity, I thought.
I don't smash them, I just scratch them up.
Okay, yeah.
I'm very lazy about putting them back in cases and things.
Yeah, you won't get scratches. So that's the other advantage of something like these Roka. So I would say if you've got the money, I would go and buy a pair of Roka or Oakley sports sunglasses. They're both absolutely amazing. Sports eyeglasses, that is. They're both amazing. They are both, you know, are brilliant for their purpose. If you're on a bit of a budget, I would get a cheap pair of the plastic frame and buy 100 silicon grippers off Amazon of different types for £3 and find the ones that help them stay in place. And that works really well for me as well.
Good glasses expertise there.
Yeah. But yeah, I will say that I do like these Rokas now though. And it's nice to have. My friend has used them for years. He's always, what he's done actually is another good idea, is he got a pretty normal frame from a sports glasses manufacturer, and they're brilliant, you know, they stay in place really well. And he basically made sure he got one that he could get an optician to replace the lenses in without going back to, you know, having to buy incredible Oakley or Roka or whoever it is lenses. So if you get quite a normal frame, like these are quite normal from Roka, you know, I could probably get these lenses just done by an optician on the cheap. Which they mold me, and then that's probably the big saving in the long run. Expensive, aren't they, glasses? That's the problem.
Don't wear them.
No, you just wear Gooda marathon based sunglasses.
$20. Gooda shades, yeah.
Tom's got this Boston Gooda shade, and he's going to get the London shade. Of course, he is. All the different shades, all the tat merch.
Yeah, they'll go in the tat drawer that I never ever use. Cool. All right, then. Well, I think that'll do for questions this week. If you are listening to this and you have a question yourself, email us at team@theruntesters.com or shoot us a message on Instagram if you want, as long as you start it with points of shoe, because yes, you get a lot of questions and they're not answerable.
Our inbox is absolutely disgraceful.
And as I always say on every one of these, if you're going to send us a question, then try and make it as general as possible so that we can we're not like a concierge service for people that have a very specific need that they want answering. If you can make it as general as possible, and that's more likely that we're going to answer it on this podcast.
Think about who else is going to benefit from the answer, and that's the main way to go.
Cool. All right then, well thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Catch you on the flippity flip. I might start saying that, Tom.
Please don't do that anymore.
Okay, I won't.
This episode of the podcast was presented by Nick Harris-Fry and Tom Wheatley. It was produced by Tom Wheatley. The music is by Fear of Tigers.